This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Margaret Spellings, the president of the University of North Carolina system, last joined us just a few weeks into her tenure in that job. She's still less than a year into her role, but she has set some far-reaching goals for the school with a new strategic plan targeting improving graduation rates, improving cost efficiency to keep education affordable, and increasing enrollment of students from low-income and rural households. She also surprised some folks by sharing her thoughts on the impact of HB2 on the university, saying it has hurt the school's ability to recruit top talent. With all those lofty goals set and with some time to settle in, Margaret Spellings has agreed to join us again here in our Spirit Square studio. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be here.
The announcement of your becoming president, and we talked about this the last time you were here, was greeted with some derision. You had some protests when you arrived on campus, and the Washington Post characterized your appointment as a disturbing new low. It seems that you got the last laugh here, because since then, nobody seems to be complaining. Do you feel you've been accepted, vindicated? What?
Well, as I recall, when I was on your show last, I said, hey, give me a chance. And a lot of people have, and I am grateful for that. And I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And as you say, just a couple of weeks ago, the board unanimously adopted a strategic plan that's very, you know, concise, coherent, and measurable. And we're off to the races. So I'm thrilled to be here and glad the naysayers have quieted.
You're just about you're 11 months, almost a year into this. March 1st was right. The one-year anniversary. Will be the one-year anniversary. Has this been a good decision on your part? Are you glad you took the job?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I've had the opportunity to serve as the United States Secretary of Education and get that bird's eye view. Obviously worked in my home state of Texas. And, you know, this is a chance to talk about policy on a scale that is really effective at a time when we need it more than ever. You know, we've got 17 very unique institutions. We in higher education have to do something we've never done before, and that is educate many, many, many more people to much higher levels, not just a game of educating elites, but educating the masses, the massification of education, as they call it.
How far behind the curve are we on that?
Well, I think we're, you know, about average. You know, we're right in the middle of the pack. And you know, we North Carolinians are very proud that we, you know, invented public higher education, if you will, founding the first public university, and that we ought to be leading the way on meeting these new demands. So we're not leading. We're not lagging particularly, but we're right in the middle of the pack. And I have some theories about why that is, but we can do better.
You were the Secretary of Education. We'll talk about this later in greater depth. But do you think that public schools and the primary and secondary schools in this country are properly preparing young people to enter university situations?
Well, not always, and not enough. I mean, certainly some of our students come to us very well prepared. There are excellent public schools across our state, across our country. But we also have major, major gaps in literacy and numeracy that really serve as an impediment and a barrier to keep kids out of college, out of higher education, and out of, you know, economic mobility, honestly. And so one of the things that's in our strategic plan is to really strengthen those relationships between K-12, the community colleges, and this institution. And, you know, a big part of our contribution there is how well or poorly we prepare teachers to go into those classrooms. And so we're running, you know, many, many teacher prep programs. And I want to look under the hood and make sure we're teaching those wonderful young people who want to contribute in our K-12 schools and giving them the best tools so they can be effective when they get there.
What has been your biggest surprise? After you sat behind the desk and a couple of weeks rolled past you, what was your biggest surprise? What could you not have anticipated?
Well, I think a couple of things. To the good, you know, the affinity that the citizens of this state have for this institution is powerful, palpable, and real. And shortly after I arrived, obviously the bond passage at 60-some percent, you know, I think given in this political day and time really is a testament to the work of this university. As I traveled the state in the first, you know, 60 to 90 days visiting every single one of these institutions, I saw what a hub of activity and intellectual life these institutions are in those communities and in those regions. So it was a very, very pleasant surprise. I also saw, because I think policymakers often think, oh, these are cushy jobs in higher education. Just the commitment, the going the extra mile, the student-centered approach, just over and over and over, really was heartening. On the other side of the equation, I'm struck by the multiple levels of kind of governance and bureaucracy and oversight. And my observation is that we've been a little anemic on articulating what our expectations are of this system, particularly for poor and minority and first-generation students, and a little too prescriptive on inputs. A lot of oversight from the Board of Governors, from boards of trustees, from the legislature. And I think we need to, you know, reverse that equation. Let's power up on the expectation side and take a lighter hand on the micromanagement.
Well, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, evidently, as you discovered. And
yes,
I think
sir.
That you are in favor of a piece of legislation that was recently introduced to reduce the size of the Board of Governors. Why is that important to you?
Well, as we look around the country at governance systems, we're really an outlier among states. You know, average governing boards are about, you know, a dozen people. You know, they range from nine to into the teens. And so I think, you know, having – it's always, obviously, no matter what the number is, about the quality of people who are on the board. So 32, you know, well-intended, very educated, fully committed people is always going to be better than nine, you know, folks who have a particular agenda or a particular pet project. But I do think, you know, if we had to start with a blank sheet of paper, particularly in a time when we're so interconnected, that, you know, fewer probably makes sense.
What about in terms of administration? Because one of the reasons for the cost of higher education being what it is that there are a lot of people associated with colleges and universities that are not in the classroom, never will be in the classroom, but they're there to facilitate what happens in the classroom, one presumes, but they're a heck of a lot of them.
Well, exactly. And not only, I mean, sometimes they facilitate what's happening in the classroom, and sometimes they're doing compliance monitoring mm-hmm. for state and federal regulations. And, you know, I'm encouraged that the new administration in Washington is going to take a look at that. I mean, there was a study recently done about a year ago that we participated in that, you know, Vanderbilt was the driver, Boston Consulting Group, that, you know, many, many millions of dollars are spent in kind of administrivia that are funds that could be spent on scholarships for students, health care provision, you know, and on and on and on. So, you know, we're scarce dollar days, and we need to spend every single dollar wisely.
When you were George W. Bush's Secretary of Education, you launched a national conversation on the future of higher education, which resulted in an action plan. How many of the recommendations in that action plan have you woven into the strategic plan that you helped design for the university?
A good many, and I think it's, you know, been about 10 years since that work was done, and it really did, you know, kick off more national conversation about some of these issues, and frankly, a lot of philanthropic investment, most notably done by the Gates Foundation and the Lumina Foundation, particularly around this new work of educating many more people to higher levels, accountability and transparency. I mean, how do we measure how good we are? How do we know what work we have to do? There's some real emphasis in our plan and in that piece of work. Access. How do we make sure that the students that come into our colleges and universities are fully prepared to be successful there? And then finally, of course, very notably, affordability.
Yeah.
You know, I think people are starting to wonder, is the value proposition there for the tens of thousands of dollars that people invest?
Explain access to me, because the university system here is a state-operated system, and it's a state school, and a lot of young people expect to go
right.
to a state-operated
exactly.
school, no matter what state they're in.
Right.
What is access all about from your point of view?
It's about a couple of things. First, it's about how well our students are prepared coming from our K-12 system to be successful, and those pathways between community colleges and our universities, between high schools and the university or community colleges. So that's what we mean. Have we done everything we can to prepare teachers, to provide information about financial aid, about college options? I mean, are we making college a reality in every sense, affordably, you know, in affordability sense, and in a preparedness sense? That's what access is about. It's also about, you know, do we have a philosophy in our universities that anyone from anywhere can be successful? You know, as I've said, and we're proud of it, You know, we've done a great job educating elites. And, you know, decades ago, you could make a darn good living without a college credential. But, you know, the majority of jobs in this state, in this country, are going to require at least 14 years of education, at least some kind of credential.
And you have said, and you said this early on, I think you said this in conversations leading up to your appointment, or in the immediate aftermath of your appointment as the head of the university system here, that education needs to be a new civil right.
I believe that. What a high school diploma was for our parents and grandparents needs to be that post-secondary credential. Not necessarily a baccalaureate degree, but some sort of, you know, ticket to the American dream. And, you know, just as we, you know, think about, you know, dropouts as kind of a scourge on our country, our school systems, and frankly, individuals, that kind of lack of completion at a post-secondary level needs to be our expect, you know, it needs to be something we really work on.
But if people aren't going for a full baccalaureate degree or a master's degree or something higher than that, is the university system the place they should be going, or should they be going to community colleges and other institutions?
Often community colleges, of course, and that's what they're built to do, to respond to their local marketplaces, to do technical training, to do licensure, to do that kind of a la carte, you know, workforce training that is so essential to our state. And there's plenty of work for everybody.
I mentioned in the beginning that one of the things you want to do is help low-income, bring in more low-income students and also rural students. And I think a lot of people understand the roadblocks that may be facing people who are low-income students and can't get access to money to come to a college. What are the roadblocks that rural students face?
Well, I think for starters, it's about expectation. Maybe I might hear this more anecdotally, but the data proves it out too, that you know, I think families really find it to be a gut-wrenching decision when their, you know, precious brainiac child, you know, leaves the community with an expectation that that child will never come back, that it's a contribution to the diminishment and the death of rural communities. But it doesn't have to be. And that's what I think is that I want to make sure that we convey, that our expectation for rural and all students is a college education. And what we can do is use technology. We can use our community colleges to expand our infrastructure. We can, you know, have better pathways and what's called articulation agreements in the trade between our K-12 system, our community colleges, and this university.
Your strategic plan for the 17 campuses of the system sets the goal of increasing enrollment of low-income students by 13% of, I think, higher than 20, well, 13% of 2015 levels by 2021. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
What will it take to get there? How do you accomplish that?
These are overarching goals for the system broadly. And when we do this, I'm confident that we will. I have every expectation that this university is up to this task. So these are our system-wide goals. What we will then do in turn is have institutional goals about what Fayetteville State's contribution will be to that, what UNCC's contribution will be to these goals. And some of those institutions will do better than that. And some, you know, our flagships with high completion rates and with, you know, a research focus will have a different set of metrics.
Let me stop you there. We'll talk more about low-income students and also raising the graduation rates of those students, which is something that you want to do when we come back. Margaret Spellings is our guest, former U.S. Secretary of Education, now president of the University of North Carolina system on Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gardner Webb University, a Christian liberal arts experience with more than 80 undergraduate and graduate major fields of study. Now accepting summer and fall applications at gardner-webb.edu. And from Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Into the Woods, Fiasco Theater's musical production about the power of wishes and what happens after they come true. February 10th through the 12th at Knight Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, where do the recent women's marches fit in with the overall arc of the women's movement throughout time? and how do today's women keep the momentum going? Some thoughts when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on listener-funded public radio 90.7 WFAE.
Immigration policy affects who can come here, which affects labor markets, which affects the price you pay for a pie.
So I'm terrified of having to say, oh no, your apple pie is now going to be upwards of $40, $45 for a whole pie.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, immigration policy and apple pie next time on Marketplace.
Tune in Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Margaret Spellings is our guest, the president of the University of North Carolina System. She's coming up on almost 1 year. She's close to 1 year in that job. And she has set up a strategic plan for the university, which we're talking about here. Part of that plan is to increase the level of low-income students coming into the university and how you accomplish that. And also, she wants to increase low-income graduation rates by even more. It was 13% more coming in, 37% higher in that same time period going out. How and what does that mean? Because it seems to me that if you want to bring people in of low income, do they have a tougher time getting out for some reason?
Sometimes, but I think that's the, you know, we need to crack the code.
Is that because the money runs out, or they can't keep the money flowing?
Sometimes, but not only. It's because they're working. It's because they can't find a pathway. They're taking too many courses. They're taking too long. So we have kind of a finish and form mentality because time is money. And so it's a variety of strategies, and that is, you know, our clarion call in American higher education. I do want to mention one thing, Mike, because it does bear mentioning. This strategic plan is not my strategic plan. It certainly is mine, but it's also the Board of Governors. We unanimously endorsed by the Board of Governors and developed through a process where we had town hall meetings at every single campus. We did a survey instrument with thousands of respondents. So it is truly a consensus plan with lots and lots of input, and one I, you know, embrace and hope to sell.
If this were to work, at least this portion of the plan,
yes,
attracting more low-income people into the system, graduating more of them out of the system,
correct.
What would that do for North Carolina?
Well, it would, you know, harness the tremendous amount of human potential and human capital that we have in this state. It would help us grow businesses. It would help us grow jobs. I hear from business leaders around the country and around this state that they can't find qualified workers. I never want to hear that again,
yeah,
because we're preparing those qualified workers to be successful in this economy.
Because one of the things that we know about Charlotte is the fact that if you're born poor here, this is one of the leading cities in the country for this. This is a very bad thing.
Right.
If you're born poor here, it is likely that you will die poor here. You will not advance in the social ladder.
Right.
This could help.
Absolutely. And again, it's back to, you know, expectation that is, you know, I used to say in my secretarial days that if half the school lunches served in the schools were tainted and people had food poisoning, we'd be on fire. But half the students not being able to read and having a life that suggests, you know, it is kind of below the radar, below the surface, and we have to change that.
And that actually begins in that elementary K through 12 system, because if you can't read and you can't calculate,
right,
you can't really succeed.
Correct.
In college, you've set this goal of improving student transitions from high school to college and community college to the university through what you call a better alignment of K-12 college and university policies, practices, and standards. So are you saying that you're going to put your fingers, the university's fingers, into the lower ed pie? How do you encourage them? How do you get these kids ready to come to you?
Well, I'm going to elevate these issues because I have worked in them for a long time, and I think the simple questions like, you know, what is the alignment between the curriculum requirements of our K-12 system and what we're teaching in our colleges of education? I mean, is there a connect there? Because if there isn't, you know, the poor teachers are having to kind of, you know, figure that out in real time as they get there. You know, are we using the best research-based practices on teaching literacy? you know, about, 15 years ago, there was the definitive word on how we teach little people to read, mm-hmm. called the National Reading Panel. And, you know, we have a lot of variance in our colleges around the country as to who has embraced that approach and sees the results that come out of it and who is, you know, kind of doing business the old way. So we got to look under the hood and see, are we training our teachers to be very effective in closing the achievement gap when they get into our schools?
And part of the problem, I think, it's not only anecdotal, we've done shows on this, is that a lot of poor children aren't read to when they're toddlers by their parents because their parents are working 2 and 3 jobs and
right.
don't have time. And
maybe can't read themselves.
Maybe can't read themselves. And so they come into the kindergarten area and they're already behind the curve at that point. But I have gone to classrooms, and I know that you have too as Secretary of Education, and you see this bright, shining light in these young people's eyes. And then something happens by fourth grade when that light starts to go out. If you don't grab them, mm-hmm. that light goes out and you have lost them. Can a university system, through its education programs, through its teacher education programs, really have an impact on that? Or is there something else going
Absolutely. On? Absolutely. Yes. We have to prepare teachers that take those little bright-eyed kindergartners and turn them into readers as quickly as possible, and we can do that. This is the thing that's so maddening about this business. We know what to do,
mm-hmm.
and we just need to be better about doing it. We can apply research. We also know, frankly, how to catch readers up who have fallen through the cracks at fourth grade. I mean, it's more expensive. It takes longer, but there's a lot of research around how to cure adolescents. Illiteracy. And, you know, it's practice, it's fluency, it's phonemic awareness, it's, you know, immersion in text, on and on and on. But we know what to do, and we need to be better about doing it.
The cost of a college education has been rising to astronomical levels, maybe not at UNC, but it certainly has elsewhere. And I think UNC is more expensive than it probably used to be.
It is.
It's gotten to the point where students are leaving with mountains of student loan debt that they may not pay off until well into middle age. And some people are doing a cost-benefit analysis of this and thinking, well, maybe this isn't a good thing to do, go to college. I mean, I'm not going to be able to make $150,000 a year to pay this debt off, so maybe I'd be better off doing something else with my time. You're aiming to keep college affordable. What needs to happen to make that so?
Well, and more than just aiming, we in our plan have given ourselves the goal of not having tuition outpace family income in this state. So it's a real test for the system, and we can do it. You know, one of the things I'm observing is, you know, as I said a bit ago, time is money. Students are often taking too many classes, staying in school too long, and finding very inefficient ways to get a credential. And obviously that costs them money and it keeps them out of the workforce. And so that's one place we can go first. We have 1.5 million students in this people in this state that have some college but no credential. Hmm. So, you know, low-hanging fruit, if you will, is to recapture those folks who have had some level of success in college and harness that potential to the good. You know, with respect to affordability, I do want to say, because it is one of the things that really drew me to this state, we are, you know, in the, you know, top tier of affordability in the country. This is a state and its citizens and its legislatures over the many decades that have made college affordable in North Carolina, and that's more true here than anywhere. Can we do better? You bet. One of the ways, I just have to say this quickly, that the legislature is working on this is they passed last session a provision called NC Promise, North Carolina Promise, where at 3 of our institutions, UNC Pembroke, Western Carolina, and Elizabeth City State, tuition for in-state students will be $500 a semester, $2,500 for out-of-state students. So for a value shopper who wants to get in and out of college, man, I would suggest they look closely at those 3 terrific schools.
This is kind of foggy in my mind, but when that was being discussed, there was some concern over that proposal that you keep tuition at that level. What was that concern about, and do you think those fears have been allayed?
There was some concern that it was, a kind of a bargain basement price. Would that suggest a lack of value? I mean, there was some observation to that extent. But I told my colleagues in higher education, these folks have done something that we have been asking them to do for many years, and that is provide more state funding so that we can keep tuition low. Mm-hmm. And they have.
I want to go back to something you said a second ago that sounds counterintuitive, and maybe have you explain it, and that is that students, some students today are simply taking too many courses and staying in school too long.
Right.
I mean, too many courses, that sounds like a good thing. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, it's...
Why is it happening?
I mean, to the extent that people learn more stuff when they take more classes, I mean, I guess that's a good thing. But what we're trying to do is get people that proxy, that credential that gets them, enhanced economic mobility. And so if your average baccalaureate degree program requires 120 to 130 course hour credits, we don't want students taking 150.
Why do they?
Because they change their mind, they can't get course A that's a prerequisite for subsequent study. They are inefficient in the way they're attacking the problem. And if you have all the money in the world and all the time in the world, there's, I guess, nothing wrong with that. But to your point, that's not true, and certainly not true with first-generation students.
So is it a matter of counseling them? Is it a matter of having more available classes in a certain area so that if one class fills up, there's another one that opens up so they can take the class they need?
Yes. It's about advising. It's about, mapping out what we call degree plans, degree maps, so that students, see, here's my trajectory to completion. It's about where there are gaps with respect to faculty and class loads and all those sorts of things, using technology to fill in those gaps. And I just saw a technology demonstration of a product that we're interested in that basically would drop in. I mean, if you need to take English 202 before you take English 303 and it's not available at your institution, it'll drop in, three technology-based options in the UNC system that you can take so you can stay on course for completing on time.
Is there any resistance to any of this within the system itself, because this is a new way of thinking?
Maybe it's too soon to tell. I mean, it's such common sense for taxpayers and for policymakers. But, I do think it will call on us to make sure that we're using people, our faculty and staff and facilities to maximum efficiency. And this kind of data, this kind of transparency, it's also part of our budget request, will help us run the place better and smarter.
So you said earlier that your plan calls for limiting annual percent increases in undergraduate resident tuition rates to no more than the increase in the median family income. Well, the median family income hasn't gone up at all in a very, very long time. So what do you have to do? What are you cutting back on? What do you have to eliminate? How do you do it?
Well, for starters, and this is why we've asked for some appropriations from the legislature, we need better management information. We need more data. We have systems that don't tell us very much about, where are we spending our resources? How much does it cost to teach a tech-based course? Is it cheaper at this place or that? And so, it's hard to know who's most successful and who's weakest without that kind of management information. So that's the first thing I'm going to do. And our board is asking for that. Policymakers are asking for that. And our institutional leaders are asking for that.
One of the things that you have suggested would be helpful is the reduction of regulatory burdens. What are some of those burdens and where did they come from?
Well, they come from all sorts of places. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. The legislature passed a pay raise for faculty and staff. And in order to effectuate that raise in our institutions, it took 188 budget amendments with the state and human resources folks and other entities to get that provision enacted. And so we can be smarter and more efficient about that. There was a performance bonus that was passed, and state human resources folks said that there will be two amounts of performance bonuses, $400 and $600, and it was kind of this one-size-fits-all mentality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a number of things. Construction projects, really, is it's a five-step process where a board of trustees endorses a particular project. Then they come to the Board of Governors. Then we go to the legislature. Then they go back to the Board of Governors. And it's just, you know, time is money. And all this regulation costs us resources that we could be spending on students.
So is there political will within the legislature to remove some of this?
Absolutely. I really think so. I'm talking to them about it. And you know, we're also committed to finding resources internally for repairs and renovations so that we can solve our own problems as opposed to running to the legislature. Again, we need to be about results. What does the legislature want and expect us to do? What do the people of the state want us and expect us to do? And please get out of the way. We'll figure out a way to chart the map to meet those objectives.
You mentioned that this plan had the unanimous approval of the Board of Governors, and another part of this plan is to grow revenue from research grants and licensing by $275 million. I've done this show for a long time. I don't think I've ever heard anybody.
Yes, you have.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk about that. I didn't even know that school. That was part of a school's revenue stream of research grants and licensing for what they've discovered. How does that work? And how does UNC rank in comparison to other schools in that area?
Well, I'm proud to say that we punch above our weight in a lot of areas, particularly around pharmaceuticals, agriculture. I mean, obviously Chapel Hill and NC State are our lead dogs in this regard. And so we get a lot of money from the federal government, and we're thrilled about it. We are less successful in leveraging those investments into the private sector, and so that's why the Board of Governors and I, you know, endorse a greater focus around that. But I'll tell you what, this is what keeps us with the best world-class faculty in these disciplines, because we garner these resources, because the level of scholarship in this university is world-class.
So when you say you're not good at right now at leveraging these things into the private sector, what does that mean exactly? That you're giving it away, or that they're not taking? You're not saying, "Hey, we have this. Don't you want it?" And here's
technology transfer. Yes, and a lot of states have done this, maybe a little better than we have. We certainly do a lot of it in places like the Research Triangle Park, where you know ideas and scholarship and discoveries are incubated in universities and then spun off into the private sector for commercialization and for the creation of employment. And we do a lot of it. I don't mean to minimize what's been done, but you know it's quite bureaucratic, and we can be smarter about how we do that, how we invest our faculty and staff into some of those discoveries and make it more attractive for them to deliver against those goals.
One of the things we've been hearing about in higher education is the increasing use of adjunct faculty, and at some institutions, the adjunct faculty has unionized essentially because they feel like they're being taken advantage of. I don't know what the ratio at UNC in the UNC system is of adjunct to full-time faculty, but is that being looked at all? Because there are some people who say that if parents knew that the adjunct faculty was getting paid minimum wage and having to work at McDonald's, they might be upset by this.
You know, that's more a phenomenon in community colleges than in the university. But I will say, you know, adjunct faculty bring a lot to the table. These are people who are practitioners, often work in professional settings. They're business people who have been wildly successful. I mean, I'm thinking about examples at, you know, Kenan Flagler, where they're not part of the professoriate, but they are, you know, very valued and valuable contributors to student learning. One of the things that's in our strategic plan is to look at, you know, who do we have, how well are we paying and recruiting and retaining them. So we're doing that work as well.
Margaret Spellings is the president of the University of North Carolina System. When we come back, I want to talk about something that's been controversial for a long time, and it started here in Charlotte, and that, of course, is...
Let me guess.
HB2. We're going to come right back and talk about that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Asthma and Allergy Center, offering patient care to all ages dedicated to treating and curing asthma and allergy challenges. 11 locations in the Charlotte area. Breathe, live, thrive. CarolinaAsthma.com. And from Birdhouse on the Greenway, February is the month to ensure birdhouses are up and ready for occupants. Bluebirds start looking for suitable nesting boxes this month, located at the shops of Piper Glen on Ray Road. Birdhouse on the Greenway. Greenway.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock, On Point's 100-day spotlight on the new administration continues. A federal appeals court stays President Trump's travel ban. The president fires back. That's the topic next hour on Point. That's at 10 o'clock, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
As President Donald Trump settles into the Oval Office, his cabinet nominees face review from Congress.
Because of their companies, because of their lifestyles.
After 20 years of knowing Senator Sessions, I have not seen the slightest evidence.
She has not, so I voted against her. And I will vote against every nominee.
NPR will be there through each hearing and appointment with the latest updates and coverage that puts the politics into context. Listen every day.
Keep up with your NPR news source, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Margaret Spellings, who joined us last time about, 30 minutes after she got the job as the head of the university system, and now she's just about a year into it. And it's been an interesting year, I'm sure, for you, particularly here in North Carolina, in part because of HB2. It's been a very contentious issue and a costly one for the state, and especially a costly one for Charlotte, and you were one of the first public figures to actually criticize the law. As president of a public university that also receives Title IX funding, you kind of been caught in the middle of this, and you said you would not enforce it. What kind of – you have to work with the legislature. Did that take them aback a bit? And what kind of reaction did you get to that comment from those folks?
Well, my job as a public servant, obviously, is to follow the laws of this state and the federal government. And when they are in tension, it gives us some issues. At the time, obviously, it was during the Obama administration. They had issued some regulations about these sorts of things. So we did find ourselves in tension and needing to find legal representation. Obviously, then Attorney General Roy Cooper declined to represent the university. So we had to spend, funds on finding representation for ourselves. You know, whether I made the legislature mad or not, you can ask them. But when you start to think about this, we're running, a $9 billion operation with lots of bathrooms, lots of dorms, lots of showers, lots of athletic facilities. And I kept asking, well, what would they have us do? I mean, are we to post guards at bathrooms and lockers and so forth to, try to, per se enforce? Would we charge people with trespassing? One of my chancellors said this was a solution to a problem we didn't know we had. And so while we certainly made our institutions aware of the law and followed the law in the sense that, signage was posted and so forth, enforcing it in the sense of guards and sanctions and this sort of thing was just not possible.
Do you think the threat of Title IX, everything's kind of on hold, I think, as this works its way through the courts, because apparently the legislature is in no mood to repeal it. But it does, under the Obama administration, it puts some Title IX funding at threat.
Right.
You think that threat will go away under a Trump administration?
I think so, and it really, even the Obama administration said it really wasn't something, they didn't want to punish students for this particular law. I mean, what it has cost us, I would say, and you all know this, is the NCAA and the ACC athletic events, obviously, that are, important parts of college life. I have heard anecdotally and said recently that, folks that we're trying to recruit from around the country and around the world, take a pause when they see this. And I think our competitors, our neighboring states, use it to their advantage.
But what about the university itself? I mean, I think I took your comments when you said it's causing serious problems for public universities, that you're having trouble attracting talent to the school. Were you talking about students? Were you talking about faculty?
I'm aware of, faculty that we're trying to recruit, world-class people that say, on second thought, I just don't think North Carolina is for me. And, you know, as I say, you know, our competitors bang the drum on that and want to use it against
Can
us.
Can you quantify that? We have statistics and data on so many things today.
No, I mean, these are people
No one's keeping score?
Well, you know, a little bit. We've lost a number of professional conferences, scholars and state employees from New York and California, obviously major powerhouses of higher education and scholarly pursuit, are not allowed to travel to North Carolina. And so if you're having a professional biotechnology conference without anyone from California, you know, people, you know, yeah. I think twice about having their meeting here.
So when they object and they say, maybe North Carolina's not for me, or maybe the university, this university's not for me because it's in North Carolina, are they saying that based on the bathroom provision, or are they saying that based on what they perceive to be discrimination?
I think more the latter, and I think, as I say, you know, our competitor states, you know, are, you know, milk it for all it's worth, because we are in a very competitive world for, you know, world-class faculty and staff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I've observed that it's been used against us.
President Trump has nominated Betsy DeVos for your old job, yes. Secretary of Education. And last week, the Senate committee overseeing her nomination narrowly voted to support her. We have two Republican senators now who said they are not voting for her. But it becomes clearer as the week goes on, as the days go on, that she's probably going to be the next Secretary of Education. She has been criticized for her performance at hearings, and many are concerned about her experience in public education, the fact that neither she nor her children went to public schools, the fact that she's an advocate for and owner of charter schools, a powerful advocate for school choice. Do you know her?
I do.
What are your impressions of her as a person first?
She is a person of high integrity. She has put her money where her mouth is for poor and minority students attending charter schools, which are public schools, I might add, quickly. She is a leader. She's, you know, has a great heart and high level of character and integrity.
Because you joined with two other secretaries of education, former secretaries of education, Bill Bennett and Rod Page, in writing a letter to two of the committee members overseeing this nomination. Is that the normal course of affairs? Does that always happen? Do former holders of the office sometimes chime in when things look rocky, or is this something extraordinary?
No, I think it's not extraordinary. I mean, you know, I was a fan of John King. I think he did a good job. I just put out a quote for him. He's about to lead the Education Trust, which is a major civil rights organization. And, I mean, I think those of us who've served in these big jobs know that anyone, whatever their pedigree, has a lot to learn when they get there. And I know that Betsy is going to be open-minded, a good listener. I've encouraged her to get about the states and into school districts, talk to people who are on the front lines doing the work, and I know she'll do that.
Do you understand why some people are alarmed at her nomination?
You know, I guess so. You know, I think people certainly have their points of view. I think, you know, there are folks that you know, vouchers and school choice are, you know, the you know, holy grail. The unions certainly feel that way. I don't.
Because when you and Rod Page, who both served as secretaries of education under George W. Bush, when you went up before the Senate, you didn't receive a lot of pushback. I mean, your nomination process, both of your nomination processes were relatively smooth sailing
yes.
in comparison to this one. Is that simply, is it background? Is it who the two of you were versus who she is? Or is it simply the hyper-partisan times in which we live today?
I think a little bit of both. I mean, Secretary Page, who had been the superintendent of Houston ISD, and I, who had been the domestic policy advisor at the White House and had relationships with a lot of these people, had worked with them on No Child Left Behind. You know, we were known entities, and that made a difference. I think a lot of people in Washington don't know Betsy DeVos, but, you know, this is not the era of Washington. This is the era of states and local control, if you will. And so I look for her philosophy to be, you know, one of facilitator and empowerment of those of us running institutions like this one.
But that worries a lot of people.
It does, because there are a lot of folks who've benefited from a very, you know, muscular role from Washington. It's just a philosophical thing. We're going to have to see, you know, what nets out better for students.
you understand this job. I'm not sure a lot of us. We just see Secretary of Education, and we just figure, well, that's the grand poobah
right.
of all the public schools in the United
it's
States.
Not.
And it's not. What is the job?
The job is being an advocate for resources that can be deployed and leveraged at the local level. I mean, you know, in K-12, we're an 8 or 9 cent investor from Washington in K-12 education. And so, you know, 92 cents on every dollar are coming from states and localities. So how do you leverage those funds, frankly, around a civil rights focus? When the Department of Education was founded as an independent agency, and initially in the LBJ and subsequently the Carter administrations as a standalone, you know, the focus was Title I, Title IX, IDEA, special education, with the idea being, you know, leveling the playing field for all of our students everywhere. And that's why accountability, transparency, those are the things that were so important to us in the Bush administration.
There are a lot of people like to see it go away. Should it go away? Do we need it in 2017?
We do indeed. And I'm not of that school either. I mean, George W. Bush, my former boss, was a different kind of Republican that did not call for the abolishment of the Department of Education. Listen, we're in a global knowledge economy, and we need that coherence, that mm-hmm. consistency, that focus, that bully pulpit leadership around these issues.
Does it trouble you, or should it trouble anybody, that a person taking that job never attended a public school and never put their children in a public school, who has never been a teacher? I don't think she's ever been. Well, I guess she's been an administrator because she owns a company that owns a charter school. I don't know if that qualifies for that, but does it bother? Should it bother us?
Well, I know that she's mentored a lot of students right. in public schools. I mean, charter schools are public schools. She has, you know, underwritten lots of scholarships for students who participate in education in public and private schools. I think what I know about Betsy is that the focus here is about the student, mm-hmm. not about the system, not about the adults, not about the delivery methods. It's about how well are students achieving. And I think that's a refreshing look. That's our number one priority.
Well, the two Republican senators who said they couldn't support her, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, said they couldn't because they questioned both her experience and her commitment to public schools. Are they wrong in that assessment?
They obviously have made that determination for themselves. I mean, what I know about her is I would not question her commitment. As anyone experienced in all the myriad programs of, you know, civil rights and financial aid and this, that, and the other thing that she's going to be called upon to do. What I want to know is, can she assemble the kind of team, the kind of capable folks around her that do have those levels of expertise so that the department will thrive?
Because there are a lot of people who are scared about the attitude that displayed by some Republicans about public education. They see that they feel or they perceive that there has long been this strategy or this plan to do everything possible to weaken the public schools so that they will go away. And that stems for support for charter schools and vouchers. They see ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, as a threat because of their comments and suggestions about public education. And now along comes a nominee to be Secretary of Education. That is troubling to them, and it looks like it's all part of a plan. Is there a plan?
Not that I'm aware of.
And
what I know for sure is that the vast, vast, vast majority of our students in this country are going to be, and in this state, are going to be educated in public schools, period, paragraph.
Are the public schools failing us?
Well, if you look at the results for poor and minority students and how well they read, many are.
And is that because we've asked public schools to do too much to be reformers of society versus educators? Or is it something else at work?
You know, that's a very esoteric question. I think you mentioned a bit ago about families who don't have literacy in the home. Look, our responsibility is to educate the students as we find them. I sent the best kids I had to the schools and expected those educators to teach them how to read and cipher with my help and my support. I've never met a parent who didn't want the best for their child.
Mm. So we shouldn't be worried that there's some vast master plan to rid the nation of public schools.
I'm not worried about it.
Because people think, you know, charter schools are public schools, but they take money from the public schools, and they operate under a different set of rules in many cases than the public schools. And it was said that we'll look at these charter schools and we'll take what works and we'll put it into public education. And sometimes that's not possible because there are restrictions against public schools. They can't do some of the things that the charter schools do.
Well, and I think it calls on all of us to ask, you know, what are those regulations that are impeding progress and garnering a lack of public support for those public schools? Do we need to look at what those regulations are as opposed to say, well, we're mad that someone has voted with their feet and decided to attend a charter school? Many, many charter schools are oversubscribed. You know, parents want those options for their students, and in my view, they ought to have them.
And in reality, if we got rid of the public schools, there wouldn't be enough private schools to take the students.
Absolutely. So we need to our mission is to make sure that every educational experience, whether it's a charter school, a private school, or a public school, especially a public school, work for students.
In addition to being Secretary of Education under the George W. Bush administration, you also spent time as a White House domestic policy advisor, which puts you right in the center of activity in the White House. Put yourself in that position and assess the first 2 weeks of the Trump administration. What's your feeling about it? Because it's been a whirlwind.
Yes, it has. Well, one of the things that I got to work on in the domestic policy portfolio were the immigration issues. Uh-huh. And, of course, I came to that from my experience in Texas with many hundreds of miles of border with Mexico and with a philosophy of in-state tuition for students, the DACA-like students that are now subject to this executive order of President Obama's. I must say, the difference between the philosophy and orthodoxy around immigration from those days to now is quite striking.
Do we need the change? Do we need the wall?
Well, we already have a bit of a wall, and I think, you know, securing our borders is important.
Sure.
But then the question becomes, you know, what about the 11 or 12 or 14 million people who are here? What about the 800,000 students in this country who were brought here by their parents at a young age, and many of them are studying in our schools?
And has this current executive order on refugees and others coming into the country, has it had an impact on the faculty or the students in the system that you operate now?
It has had some limited effect, yes. Obviously, we have scholars and students who are from those countries, and we've advised them not to travel until, you know, this is sorted out. And, again, I think it has sent a chill through the university.
We'll have to leave it there because we are out of time, but I want to thank you for coming back, and I hope you'll come back again as things unfold at your level up in Chapel Hill. Margaret Spellings, president of the University of North Carolina System. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.